I'll come to order. There we go. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, would you?
Mr. President.
Motion, please.
I move that the Senate resolve itself back into committee of the whole.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. That motion has passed. Got to ask Senator Driscoll to return to the desk, please.
Committee of the Whole will come to order. We will continue on House Bill 38, Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, trying to answer a few questions that did come up before we broke. The transportation is deducted when the transportation is away, well, then that is able to be deducted. And the legislature always have the option of setting the value or a formula for the value and, of course, the tax. And on another one that I said and I wasn't completely correct on, the severance pay is due monthly. The coal companies have to submit that severance pay each month, and they do not have all the figures at that point, so they do it on an estimate. And then at the end of the year, they get their figures, and also they are all sent to the Department of Revenue. And by June 1st of the following year, the Department of Revenue certifies to the county commissioners the correct amount for production and severance taxes. They said that I asked if that was the point when if there was appeal, and they said there was very seldom ever an appeal at that point. It was something that came up during the year that there was some disagreement on how some of the taxes was filed. Probably Campbell County is the one that received the greatest amount of ad valorem taxes, and I had an email from them last night that they supported the bill as amended. There was some questions on the fiscal note. I have a copy here, but if anybody would like one, I need to get a clean copy and distribute it, because the one I have right now is pretty full of notes and would be kind of hard to follow through. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll try to answer any other questions.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, Article 15, Section 11. Wyoming Constitution. All property except in this Constitution otherwise provided shall be uniformly valued its full value as defined by the legislature. Mr. Chairman, it would appear that the provision on page 3, lines 1 through 14, where you have the different percentages, and I know this was the figures were modified by the Standing Committee Amendment, but there's still different percentages depending on which county you're in, and trying to segregate the Powder River Basin out from the rest of the state. It would appear to me on the face of it that that provision violates Section 15, Article 11, the piece that I just read, because that doesn't sound uniformly valued to me at all. So the question I have, Mr. Chairman, and this is an area that I think we have to be careful treading in, because sometimes the court precedents are such that what we think the Constitution says, maybe it doesn't quite. But my question is twofold. One, did the committee hear from objective legal counsel, not somebody with an axe to grind, but Attorney General or LSO or somebody give you an independent opinion as to whether or not the difference in percentages is constitutional? The second question is, this is an area where there's enough money at stake that it's reasonable to expect a court test if we've done something that might not be constitutional. Would we be wise to preclude that by using a uniform percentage across the state, now split the difference or somehow get a one percentage we can use for the whole state? Because there is a great virtue, as was explained earlier, in simplicity here. But not if it gets you into losing court case. And I have a suspicion that if we change these percentages, there's a significant amount of money at stake, and that's not something we should do lightly. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the nature of my questions, and it really comes to whether there's, in fact, a constitutional issue regarding uniformity evaluation here.
Senator Hines, to answer that question, and I'm racking my brain for maybe somebody in Revenue Committee can help me, that we had a bill just within the last week that had different formula, different, and I brought up that exact question about being uniform and equal, and I've been told where that same avenue exists in several sections of the statutes on Chapter 39 on revenue. And we did not ask that question directly to any attorney, but the feeling was that it is constitutional, or at least it had never been challenged. It is something I would have to go and get a direct opinion from, and I can try to do that. As far as having one ratio statewide, as I looked at this chart that was given us, the direct ratio that we've used, and it varies every year from 2000 to 2010, it in the Powder River Basin, it went from 72.8 up to 79.5. That was a high and a low range. In the rest of the state, the low range was 80.3, and it has gone up to 82.4. So I can't answer the question about whether we could have one ratio for the whole state, because it would certainly affect different industry or different mines within the industry cost. Those are two things that I would need to confer with other people before I can give you any better of an answer than what I did.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With regards to the constitutionality of the tax, I think we have to kind of back into it a little bit and think about it. The Constitution provides that taxes shall be levied at the mine mouth. The problem is that these are there's no sale that occurs at the mine mouth. So there is an accounting exercise that we go through to try to determine a pseudo rate for the value of that mineral at the mine mouth. And every single mine is different. Every mine has different cost characteristics. By broad class, you've got the Powder River Basin and the other mines in the state, which are different and have similarities. But even within those classes, they're quite different. They may employ different technologies. Some mines may use, in the coal industry, may use a drag line, and others use loaders, and they have more direct mining costs if they use smaller equipment, for example. It all depends on each mine and each mine's particular situation. And it's a very complex formula. There's a lot of auditing, and it changes over time. That's another problem. Especially you can think in the Powder River Basin, it's very obvious as the mines get deeper and they follow those coal seams as they go downhill towards the Big Horn Mountains, they have to remove more overburden. So the direct cost ratio is going up. And we can wait it out, and it'll pass the 79%. It'll move up into the 80s eventually if we wait it out, and we will indeed get more taxes. But that's kind of the rub, because the whole thing, we're standing back and looking at it and saying, gee, is it fair to have a situation where a company's costs are increasing and yet they're being taxed more per unit of production? And I think that's why this bill came. Now, I need to explain, I'm a no vote in committee. I don't think we're quite there yet. But I think that we do have an issue here that in moving from this individual ratio that actually is counterintuitive, because as costs go up, the mines have to pay more per ton of product in terms of taxes. That's a little bit counterintuitive. I don't see where that's necessarily meets the mandate of the Constitution. We have other choices. We could change our Constitution and get away from this point of valuation. And it might be worth talking about that. But in terms of coming up with one ratio, one pseudo deal, it has advantages. There's no question about it. And it supports the coal industry, because it says now you can make those investments, and we're not going to discourage you from making those investments, because we're not going to tax you more if you improve your efficiencies at your mines. Yeah, but there's the rub. From the state's point of view, those mines are getting deeper and deeper and more costly, and we are looking at more future revenue if we let it just play out without passing this. So I just don't think we're quite there yet on the bill, but I think if we've been having individual tax rates for all these mines to get at the constitutional mine math taxation, it doesn't seem to be much of a leap to go to one tax rate and still remain constitutional.
No. Senator Scott.
Chairman, that raises a further question in my mind. We are trying to tax it based on the value at the mine mouth. And I can understand why you deduct transportation costs from some point where you have a sale value, and you deduct transportation costs back and some of those other costs to try to get the valuation at the mine mouth. But why does the cost of production have anything to do with its value at the mine mouth? That escapes me. It seems to me that the value at the mine mouth is independent of the cost of production from a tax point of view. You know, from a producer's point of view, it determines what the profit is. But this is not an income tax. This is a property tax on the value of production at the mine mouth. And why is a piece of coal more valuable or less valuable if it costs more or less to produce it and get it to that mine mouth? It seems to me that the value at the mine mouth is independent of that production cost. And I don't frankly understand why we get into the business of what the technology is of producing it. That's the mine operator's business and none of ours.
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, the coal come out of the mouth of the mine in all different sizes, shapes, and forms, according to the mining method. To sell the coal, it has to be processed into what the buyer wants, whether it's little cubes, some of it is very fine for different furnaces, some are bigger chunks, and as you see on railroad trains as they move, there are different sizes in the coal. And so it has to be processed before they can sell it, because the buyer will not take this different size coal. You can't just take it out of the mine and put it on a car and ship it. Or you did, but if you did, nobody would want it. It wouldn't fit their operation. So that's why we take it out and process it and then sell it. And that is part of the reason we take that processing cost off, so the value will be back at the mouth of the mine. And then, Mr. Chairman, on the constitutional question, I thank the senator that gave the information. But also, we've used different values on the chart I have for at least 10 years. We've used a weighted average in the two different parts of the state, and they have varied several percentage each year. So that, you know, like I say, get back to the constitutional question. If it's wrong now, it's been wrong for I don't know how many years in the past.
Senator Raffles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, my concern is not necessarily with this concept of changing to simplify it, because I think simplification of the tax code is certainly a handy thing and might be of great benefit, so I'm sympathetic towards that. But my concern is with regard to what the specific industrial factors are going to be. And we've seen evidence that indicates that for some of the counties, specifically called out Campbell, Converse, Johnson, and Sheridan, the 81% has been relatively stable for a lot of years. It's bounced around a little bit. It's gone from 80 to 82 for the last 20 years. So it's probably a fairly reasonable number we're looking at the 81.5% with regard to the amendment being in place. But when you look at the data for the other locations, I'm reversed here. The 81% is for the southwest part of the state. The 79% or 79.5% is for the Powder River Basin. When you look at the Powder River Basin, this industry factor, if you calculate it, if you back calculate what it actually was dating back until about 1993, as far back as this data goes, it's been linearly increasing over that entire time at about 0.5% per year. So what we are basically going to do with this piece of legislation is set a point and stabilize it into the future, even though if you extrapolate almost 20 years of data, it would predict that it would continue to grow at 0.5% per year into the future. Now, I haven't seen any evidence that indicates that that isn't what's going to happen. So I think this is not only a simplification, but a substantial future tax break. If that is the case, I recognize that we can come back and revisit it. But if we change this piece of legislation without adapting to that future linear increase, it's going to be a tax increase that we're going to have to come back in here and vote on in the future. I mean, that's what will be brought to the floor. Do we want to increase taxes? And then we'll have a difficult time passing that. So it looks like it's fairly reasonable to set that 81% for the southwestern part of the state if we can find a constitutional remedy. But I'm not convinced that the 79.5% is the future value. It looks to me like it's going to be linearly increasing into the future, so we would be decreasing revenue into the future. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, the purpose of this is because they're one of the purposes. The cost of mining as the mines continue, as they get older, they get farther away from the processing plant, from the transportation, they continually have increased cost. And the way the formula worked tonight, those increased costs are being taxed. And the formula has proposed that they would be steady. And this is part of the reason for the three-year look back to see if these proposals are correct. Currently, if you look at these, they did change a little bit up and down some, the formula is not steady in either part of the state, where in the current ratio we're using doesn't just naturally climb. It has been up, 1 year it'd be up to 82, and the next year would be down to 81. And this is because of the different, as I understand it, the production costs, processing costs, that all get added back in that complicated formula we have to get to this ratio that we're currently using.
Senator Burns?
Mr. Chairman, I have much the same concern as the tall senator from Natrona County about how the cost of production ties into the tax. In the last 40 years, the production of coal has actually, through technological means and good management, has actually gotten cheaper. The mines don't have as many coal miners as they had before. The cost to produce a ton of coal has gotten lower. And the coal companies didn't come to us and ask us to increase taxes because their cost of coal is cheaper. Now you're saying that the cost of production is going to be higher, so our taxes should be lower. I don't see what one really has to do with the other from a governing standpoint. But I'm going to leave that for now. I've got two other questions. One has to do with the fiscal note from the original bill, and it projects net revenue losses to the state. Starts out in fiscal 2013 and deals with the Budget Reserve Account, General Fund, Mineral Trust Fund, School Foundation, Ad Valorem, and they all suffer, state suffers losses of income, and it about doubles each year from 13 to 14, then 15 drops about 50%. And so the question I have, this bill makes this new rate retroactive to January 1st, 2012. In other words, we're talking about the coal that's been produced for 2 months now. So why is the fiscal note only deal with 2013? If this passes and it is retroactive January 1st, isn't the state going to suffer revenue losses in 2012? And the other question I have, Mr. Chairman, deals with, I don't quite understand the point of the 2015. I think the good senator from the Ivory Tower made a good point that come 2015, and this report comes in and says, well, the state has lost substantial amounts of money, which the fiscal note says we're going to anyway. What are you going to do about it? Are we going to vote on a tax increase? So the question would be, why don't we put a sunset in here for 2015 so that if it turns out the results are that the state's lost substantial funds, then we can just do nothing and let the rate go back. But if it turns out that this is just great and wonderful, then the legislature can take an active role and extend these new rates and ratios.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hines.
This calls for it starting in 2012, and the ad valorem taxes, while there's nothing shown for 2012, because they're figured on the prior year. So that is already set. That would not change. The projections are for the severance tax that comes to the state government, as I stated before, and the updated fiscal note, which has not been passed out at this point, does show losses to the state in 2014 and 15. But that's using the current last year's production level, which was 3%, coming in 3% lower than the figures used, and the price is also going down. And the future will on whether those are losses or increases or taxes will depend on how much coal is produced and what prices is sold at.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on the good chairman, excuse me, and to make a few points, what we heard in committee, there was the amendment that we voted on today in the standing committee amendment, where we raised it by 0.5%, basically brought this much closer to revenue neutral. By raising it 0.5%, we decreased the amount of tax loss. In other words, you increase the amount of tax by raising the rate. So it's so what we did by doing the amendment is we cut the fiscal note probably by at least 2/3. But keep in mind, as we talk about that, as you look at the fiscal note, please be aware that what we're talking about is about just in severance taxes, about $500 million a year, about $1 billion of biennium in taxes this affects. So if you're looking at this rate and we talk about 0.5%, that moved it maybe $7 or $8 million under the projection. But you'd have the same, you'd have a bigger, I would guess, and I was playing around with some numbers yesterday when in committee meeting we were talking about this bill, that if you raise if the price of coal changes a dime, it has as much or more effect than moving this rate up or down 0.5%. We're talking about 300 million tons of coal a year coming or being mined, in excess of 300 million tons a year. So, if I remember the numbers right, of coal being mined. So, if you change the production changes by 60 million tons, which is not a huge fluctuation that we have in the overall coal production state of Wyoming, that also will have a significant effect on the rate of revenue. And what we're and the amount of revenue that's generated from the severance taxes and the ad valorem taxes that are computed as a part of this rate. But in doing that, and going back to a couple of other things, one of the reasons you want to head to this, and one of the reasons that simplification is a good thing, is exactly for some of the concerns that my good colleague from Natrona County has talked about, and my good friend from Sheridan County has talked about, is ultimately, that's the battle that you get into. Whether are these production costs or are they transportation costs to get them to the tipple, which is where this coal is actually sold, and that's the big hassle. That's where most of those lawsuits go in the coal valuation, is they're going to each mine, and you're looking at the costs that it takes for production versus transportation to get it to the tipple, where it's loaded, where the transaction sale actually occurs. And it's been said, what we're trying to do and what this is all about is trying to back off the cost to get it, the difference between the cost that would be at the mine mouth and the cost that would be at the tipple, which is at the point of sale. And so you're trying to come back and estimate these amounts and figure out what that amount is. And I think it's counterintuitive, but I think the nature is that the equalization issue is, if you went to one factor across statewide, I think that's the violation of the equalization requirement of the Constitution. And the reason is because each of the mines have a separate cost that's associated with that. And so when you come back and you have, if your costs in the Powder River Basin are 2 to 3 or 4 or 5% less, and you fix a statewide rate, that's a violation of equalization, because now it's not being fair. They're not being taxed at the value at the estimated value at the mine mouth. And so the equalization doesn't come because we have two. The equalization comes because we only have two and don't have one for each mine across the state. Because the equalization says it's the value at the mine mouth, and to get to the valuation at the mine mouth, you have to go back and you have to apply a factor or actually look at the costs associated with getting it from the mine to the tipple, where it's loaded and where the contract price is, what the contract price is. And so equalization says everybody gets to deduct their production, or their, not their production costs, but their transportation and processing costs in order to get to the valuation at the mine mouth. And so if you have one, you increase the equalization, the equalization constitutional challenge by only having one. In fact, reducing it from each mine individually to just two creates equalization, because equalization says you have to tax them all the same, which is you have to get back to the value at the mine mouth. And you can't take the costs of processing, the cost of transportation in one area or one mine, and if you impose those same costs on another mine, then you violated the equalization, because then it's not the value at the mine mouth. It's the value. So the charge is that the risks for constitutional challenge doesn't because we have two. It's because we don't have one for each mine. And by even decreasing it and trying to lump them all into one cost percentage, I would suggest to you that is probably even a more egregious constitutional violation than having one uniform, because it's not this determination isn't the uniform essence of taxation. This is only to get it back to the estimated fair market value. Keep in mind that each coal mine will have its individual long-term contracts which determine the price of coal, and that's not uniform either. So all you're trying to do with this is getting back to find an estimated valuation at the mine mouth. And what we found out over experience is that over the years, what happens with the counties is a lot of them, a number of the mines are paying in the estimated ad valorem taxes, the estimated severance taxes, are paying that in so that the counties have normal. Then what they do is they come back after the audit, and then the counties either have to refund some of the money that they got earlier, which we heard testimony, that's a real issue for some counties. They get that money, and when all of a sudden it turns out that the estimated taxes are overpaid and that the mining companies do a refund, it creates a substantial hardship on counties to have to give that money back that wasn't theirs in the first place. And then of course the other side is if they've underpaid or underestimated those taxes, then the counties get a big check at the end as well. But the fiscal note, I would submit to you that the fiscal note issues are really kind of in the noise. They're almost rounding errors when we're talking about the quantities of coal and the quantities of dollars that are involved. They're almost in rounding errors when we talk about fiscal note. But nevertheless, that was the purpose of the amendment, was to, by increasing it 0.5%, I think it basically knocked about $10 million off the overall projected effect of the of the fiscal note, and made it essentially, the object was to get it as revenue neutral as we could. But as far as, and I know it's counterintuitive, but I think that that's the issue with equalization. And again, going back to the purpose of the factor is to get away from those issues, because there's going to be some costs that are clearly production. There's going to be some costs that are clearly processing, but in all those things, then there's a whole range of costs that are probably part processing and part production, and that's where all the audits, and that's where the lawsuits, and that's where the things go. And we have, in the past, by not having the simplified tax bill, we have huge amounts of money that are placed in accounts that are sit there while the stuff gets litigated out. That certainly doesn't benefit the industry, and it certainly doesn't benefit either the state or the counties who are relying on that money, but now it's in suspense because we're arguing about it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Roth. Senator Martin. Go ahead. Senator Martin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Microphone. Senator Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question I have is relates to different types of mines. In Sweetwater County, we have two surface mines, and then we have an underground mine. So would the industry factor be the same at the 81.5% for the surface mine and for the underground mine, or is there a different factor that would be used for the underground mine?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hines.
According to this bill that at all these factors, they would be the same. In any of our discussion, it never came up about the, I think there's one underground mine and two or three surface mines, if I understand it, in the Southwest, and there was no discussion about any different ratio for whether it was an underground or a surface mine.
Senator Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been receiving, as I would assume some other folks have been receiving, emails from our county treasurers and about how it impacts our county, Sweetwater and Lincoln County, at least in the Southwest. Could we have some idea or ask the Revenue Department to put together an estimate as to what the impact may be to the counties as far as revenues, tax revenues that go into the county?
I do not have for individual counties. For this last fiscal note I got from the Department of Revenue yesterday, they the school foundation fund, the ad valorem tax in 2012, would gain $213,000. In 2013, it would gain, they show no gains because they are on the previous year. So the first one would be in 2014. It shows the ad valorem taxes to go up $290,000, and then the $65,800 that would go to the school fund. Those are both positive figures. There in 2015, the total would go down, looks like right at $750,000. That this industry, in the 3 years that they were showing these fiscal notes, where it showed a loss of $3.5 million, during those 3 years they've been paying $1.5 billion. They pay about a $500 million a year in taxes, so it's a very small amount in their budget. Well, seems like a lot of dollars to you and me, but in those total figures, it's not a very big percentage. Severance tax is on coal is the highest, I believe, of any in the state. It's 7%. And then they also tax the roughly 6% ad valorem tax.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, there are two separate issues here. One of them is simplification, and the other one is revenue neutrality. I think we're doing a good job on the simplification side, but with regard to the revenue neutrality, you know, we can't have it both ways on this discussion that we say, well, this is just rounding error, these numbers don't matter, they're trivial. If all of that is the case, then I'm going to assume that no one would resist me increasing these numbers. I'm going to assume that I would have no backlash, no response if I wanted to kick them each up a couple of percentage points. I'm going to guess, Mr. Chairman, that if we wanted to do that, if I put out that amendment, that we would hear back that these are not as simple and trivial and just mere rounding errors as we had assumed in this debate. Now, when we look at the trend, we can see that that 0.5% change based on this amendment, which was a good amendment, it does take us closer to value neutral in this biennium and in the next biennium. If we project forward, we are not budget neutral. A budget projection based on data from the Department of Revenue indicates that we'll be losing somewhere around $4 million, then $6 million, then $8 million as you project forward. That's not revenue neutral. If we want to come up with a revenue neutral solution, I'm happy to try and do that. We can use our best projections right now, Mr. Chairman. We can come up with a sloped increase over time, and then we can certainly come back and look at it just as this piece of legislation says to see if it's a fair approach. So if what we want is simplification and budget neutrality, we can get there. It's just that this bill doesn't do that in the long run. It's certainly simple, but in the long run, Mr. Chairman, it is not budget neutral.
Senator Nicholas.
Discussion with respect to whether or not this method, which is a surrogate for the ideal, that is having a sale at the mouth of the mine, And so you're taking, the further remote you get from the mouth of the mine, the harder it is to take that price and back it into presuming what the value, the fair market value is of the mouth of the mine. Well, the methodologies for taking a remote sale is essentially a tax concept in general. It's sort of a depletion allowance, but it's an accounting method. What I'd like to ask those that are more familiar and heard the testimony, you know, these methodologies, whether you call it the proportionate profits methodology, depletion allowances, as your costs change, and, for example, if you have more overburden, it may or may not then that formula need adjusting from time to time. Formulas are adjusted when you're using the depletion allowance proportionate profits method, because ultimately the test is, what is the fair market value at the mouth of mine? Now, here's the difficulty. If you're assuming that the formula that is in existence today will never be modified and will always reflect fair market value, and does, then it's a proper comparator to say, look, this has to arrive at that value. But if the model has changed from time to time because of your cost, or somebody comes in and says, wait a minute, the model worked last year under those circumstances, but now we have new circumstances, and here's what the accountants, because it's really an accounting now, CPA concept, these things now have to be modified. And I've represented clients like this, and as things change, you have to come in and modify the formula. So comparing what one formula will applied constantly over time, assuming that it will always arrive at fair market value, and that is the threshold, that's a tricky analysis, because those models do get changed when factors change. The real issue becomes, the real question is does the new model derive, is an appropriate surrogate for fair market value? Let's take sand and gravel. It's something everybody has a better understanding with. So you go out, some people blast their limestone, some people dig their sand out at the riverbank. Two different cost of production. But at some point, if it's half-inch aggregate, whether or not you blasted it to get there or whether or not it took you $2 to go and dig it out and wash it, the road guy's buying it, it's the same price, $5 for a half-inch aggregate. What we've done in that situation is, instead of going through the analysis of saying that we're going to look at, and since those sales, again, are 10 miles away from the mouth of the mine, and one guy had to blast it, crush it, put it in his truck and take it over it, this guy had to just dig it out, wash it, and take it in, the same product. It got so difficult that we said years ago, we're going to tax all sales 25% of the sales price. We're going to assume that's what the value was at the mouth of the mine, even though we know there are differences. So we do this in order to make things easier, but periodically you have to go back and say, have we arrived at fair market value on a constitutional basis? And what I'm having difficulty is this model, the proportionate model, I know that changes, because the model might work under some circumstances and then 5 years later. And so the question is, was that just described? What assurances did the committee receive that, in fact, this will arrive at fair market value on a pretty constant basis?
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, my memory is short, so I'll start with the last question first. The talk that we heard, and what was everybody was the industry people was wanting to make it simpler. They was not asking, they told me very directly, they was not asking for a tax reduction. They wanted to make it simple. And so, to compare, we do not know what the cost of coal will be in the future. And that's the only way you can get an accurate long-term prediction, is knowing the cost of coal or any product, and there's no way to determine that. The only way is for a review process. We have this in for 3 years. If we need a little bit of time, or the industry and the Department of Revenue needs a little bit of time so we can review those figures that they come up with and see if it is working. If you look on these charts, we arrived at these figures. We arrived originally at the 79 and the 81 because that was virtually the high figures they had for the last 10 years. And then when we got the figures that in the future, if things stayed on the prices and the production that the Department of Revenue used, it would not be neutral. There would be a slight reduction in their taxes. And so then we came up with the 79.5 and the 81.5 to get closer to that point. At that point right now, for this year and next, they show that they are revenue neutral. In fact, very slightly increased. But when you go out into the future, that's when the negative balance come in, and those again are the figures on cost. So I would say the only way we can do this in the future is just to keep monitoring it. If the body thinks the date in there for 2015 is too far off, we can shorten that up, or we can, with what information available, we could look at it every year. And, of course, of all tax rates and values and whatever we have that's not in the Constitution, the legislature can change it every year.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on a couple things, you know, ultimately, if the purpose of this ratio, and to get back specifically to the question from the good chairman of appropriations, was the Department of Revenue came in and they looked at that and they basically said, yes, this is as close, this number's as good as any other number. Were they, could they guarantee us that it was the exact number? Absolutely not, because these numbers change every year. They change from producer to producer. But the Department of Revenue looked at this and they were not concerned that this was not accurately reflecting that. In addition to that, I'd also point you to page 3 of the bill, lines 16, beginning in line 16. That's why in doing this, because this is a new thing, because it's a new formula, and indeed to address the concerns that were expressed by the Chairman of Appropriations, we have the Department of Revenue shall compare the tax which would have been paid under the existing statute with to the changes made under this statute each year. So we'll look at that each year to see if indeed we're revenue neutral or we're not. As far as the whether it goes up or down or not, it doesn't have as anywhere near as much to do with this tax, with this cost formula, as it does the actual production or the value. I mean, what we're talking about, if you take and work the numbers back here, we get $500 million a year in severance taxes. There's a 7% severance tax on coal. If we're, that's $7 billion of coal sales a year, if I do my math right. So it's actually more than that. It's, you take $500 million divided by 0.7, it's probably about $7 billion worth of coal. So, if you change the price of coal a dime on $7 billion, those are such big percentages. And you're also talking about over 300 million tons of coal a year as well. I mean, we're the largest coal exporter in the country. So if we're going to do that, and I would suggest, and also going back to answer one question from the senator from Sweetwater County about the difference between subsurface coal and surface coal, while that application applies, this is a cost factor that applies across the board, or would across, depending on which region you lived in or your coal mine was in. There's also an acceptance in the severance tax. Severance tax is less for subsurface coal, and so there's some recognition that there's additional issues related to subsurface coal. But that's Mr. Chairman, just trying to address those questions and also coming back that the Department of Revenue has looked at this. They think that this is a fair approximation for this period of time. It's been bumped a little bit, which The Department of Revenue said, yeah, that's fine. That number's as good as so many others because it is an approximation. And so you can't get it exact. And I would submit to you that $3 million out of $1 billion of biennium, you know, it's just, you know, those are numbers that are, when you're talking about that $7 billion of coal sales, you don't have to fiddle with that very much to have a, you know, several million dollars move back or forth. And again, we're much more likely to see revenues shrink or go up or down, not because of this, but because coal sales go up or down, or the price of coal goes up or down, or the quantity changes.
You ready for the question? All of those in favor of Senator Hines' motion that when the Committee of the Whole writes a report, do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 38, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 38 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration. Senator Coe.
I have a guest here today. Was president of the Senate when I came down the very first year, and I know you people here think that's probably back closer to statehood. And there's only two of us here that served under this gentleman, and it's my tall friend from Natrona County and I. And I just wonder if Russ Zimmer came down here in his truck. But anyway, I want you to welcome Russ and his grandson, Shane. I know that Senator Meyer wants to say something, so then we'll welcome him.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I just want to offer a special thank you to the former president of the Senate. We spent quite a little bit of time at Rotary in different functions, and Russ has always been a mentor, and we have great discussions about, you know, how it used to be done, what we're doing now, what we should be doing, and I tell you one thing. Listen to this guy if you get a chance. And thank you very much, Senator Zimmer.
Well, if he's your mentor, is that being a
You're on.
Is it on now? Oh, no. Well, I'd just like to say I haven't been around here for a long time, but I sure have fond memories of this institution. It's one of the finest institutions that you could ever ask for or be around, and I've had the fortunate to be in a lot of places, a lot of time, and I think the Wyoming Senate is very unique. After I left the Senate, I decided, since I was interested in politics, to visit every capital in all 50 states, and I accomplished that in about 10 years. It took 10 years to do it. A lot of them do it differently, but you're friendly, you're honest, and that's one of the biggest things that I've felt, that the honesty comes out of this institution is unequaled in my estimation. So I'm glad to be back here. You do a good job, and I want you to keep it up. Thank you very much.
Senator Scott.
Chairman, may I have the privilege of the floor?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, there was an allusion to the famous truck. And I would beg the chairman and the body's indulgence, because I think most of the members that are here now have not heard this story. And it's one of the classic legislative stories. And I'm going to have to use some proper names. I hope everybody forgives me for that. What happened, the Department of Agriculture had asked for a new large truck to test scales. One of their jobs is to test scales on semi-sized trucks to make sure that they're accurate. And the Appropriations Committee, being the Appropriations Committee, said no. Well, the Department of Agriculture knew in that circumstance you go to your friends. I think Russ at that time was probably chairman of the Ag Committee. And he came with a budget amendment. Add $50,000, as I remember, to buy them their new truck. Be up to date. And he explained it, you know, just like we all do when we buy a car, when it gets to a certain point needing maintenance, it's cheaper to go out and buy a new one. And he had us pretty much all convinced. And then Senator Geist got up. And he said, look, when those of us in the business have this problem, we don't go buy a new truck. We get it overhauled. It's going to cost you $5,000 like what's in the budget and not $50,000. And these were earlier days. The costs weren't as great as they are now. And we said, oh, okay. Value of having experience on the floor. And the amendment went down on our standard roll call. It went down 29-1. And Russ was in marvelous good humor about it. And for quite a number of years, when a member sensed that they were about to go down by that kind of a margin, they would often say, I think I hear Russ Zimmer's truck revving up out in the lobby. And there's a sequel to the story. I sell my cattle in Tarrington at the livestock sale barn there. And Russ's Z&W Mills is right next to it. And I was walking up the street. It used to be a fast food restaurant up the street. I was walking up the street to get a bite to eat a couple of years after this happened. And I walked by Z&W Mills, and there on his scale testing it was the Department of Agriculture truck. And guess what? It was brand new. And when we went home, the Department of Agriculture said, we're the Department of Agriculture, and we do things first class. The heck with those legislators. We're going to get a new truck. We got enough. We can find enough in the budget to do it. So when you think, particularly on some of the details, that we're making a big difference down here, be cautious. It may not work out that way.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 40. The reader will please read the bill. House Bill number 40, sponsored by Representative Byrd, optional sales use tax uses and acts relating to taxation and revenues. It was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Emmerich, Hines, and Perkins. No, Senator Case, Senator Hines, Chairman.
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so with a do pass recommendation on House Bill 40. There is a standing committee amendment, and I'll ask that the reading clerk please read it in at this time.
House Bill 40, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, to engross copy, page 1, line 1.
Mr. Chairman, first there is also a Committee of the Whole amendment. With your indulgence, I will ask that it be read in.
House Bill 40, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, to engross copy, page 1, line 7.
Mr. Chairman, I move both Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 and Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, and I'll ask that we take up the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 before we get into discussing the bill. And what this amendment is staff brought it to me. This bill has to do with sales and use taxes and the purposes we use them for. But the staff told me we needed this amendment to make sure it was clear that it also included use tax as well as a sales tax. And that all it does on the committee of the whole member number one, so I ask for the question on it.
Question being called for. You ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Hines' motion to adopt the committee of a whole amendment number one to House Bill 40, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is passed.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 40, which I'm going to try to handle for the co-sponsor who is in the chair presently, is the optional sales use tax uses. And basically, what this bill would apply to what we call the sixth penny, that for specific purposes, that they can petition to the local governments, and there's a process they go through, and then if the there are agreements among the entities within the county, then it goes for a vote. And when they're having this tax, it has to be for a specific purpose, and it have to have a dollar value on that they're going to collect with this extra penny tax. And then when that dollar amount is raised, the end of that quarter, then that tax is reduced, goes off. What this bill called for was to allow major maintenance, renovation, or construction on specific sections of the public roadway be used as one of the purposes that the 6 cents could be used for. And what the committee did is in standing committee number one, we removed not only the proposed language, but the language that is currently in the law that is on page 2, lines 6, 7, and 8, that says specific purposes shall not include ordinary operations of local government except for operation related to a specific project. So if this amendment is adopted, then it would remove the limitations that a local government can use when they have the sixth penny. They can use it for road construction, major maintenance. The only restriction would be that they would have to list that special purpose on the ballot when they were presenting it to the people in the county. This is the amendment and basically the bill. So to make it clear, if the amendment passed, then the bill would allow the sixth penny to be used for any purposes as long as it was specific on the ballot. What we talked about was road repairs. And the original idea was to have a certain street. But what this would allow, as I understand it, that the city could say, we want this specific tax to repair and Main Street, to repair and build main streets in the city of Cheyenne. And so that would give them a bigger leeway than it is now. Now it'd have to be pretty specific, and it can't be for regular, ordinary operations of local government. So this is basically the bill. I'll try to answer any questions.
Senator Nicholas.
Well, Mr. Chairman, with respect to the new language, as I read it now, the community could simply say that the specific purpose for this tax are or is local government operations or all salaries. So in essence, now we have 2/5 cent options, and local governments will always drive these dollars to the operations given the opportunity. And part of the protection of many taxpayers was knowing that one would go to project-specific purposes and one to general operations. But is that your intent, to simply say it would be sufficient to say this tax is for the general operations of the city of Laramie?
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, on and against the amendment, I think the good senator from Albany County has put his finger on the problem with this. The 6-cent sales tax we're talking about here has been geared and designed so people in the community could have a vote on a specific project and say, look, this is something we really want and we're willing to pay for. Classic use of it was the new library in this county. It's frankly a luxury, and it's a luxury the community decided through the 6-cent optional was one worth having and paying for, and they did it. The bill as it comes to us adds the major maintenance reconstruction of specific sections of public roadways to that list. It broadens it, all right. It gets into something that you could do with general operating funds, but it's still specific project, and the other provisions of the law that are not printed in this bill that make the 6-cent work for specific projects still apply perfectly well. What the amendment does is broaden it so greatly that it really is another 5-cent tax. And I think that it's a mistake, Mr. Chairman, to go that far. I think that the specific project nature of this 6-cent has served this state and its people well, and we would be wise to retain that feature as it comes to us, and you can debate up and down whether or not we ought to have roadways in there as opposed to just things like event centers, convention centers, libraries, jails. Those are the things it's been used and proposed for. But this changes the bill mightily, probably not so much as to be unconstitutional, but it's a mighty change in it. And, Mr. Chairman, I think an unfortunate one. I urge the Senate to reject it.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, and to continue on that same concern, one of the virtues of the having specific projects is that they were termed out. So you would know that you've got projects that cost X amount of dollars. At the end of the day, the tax comes off, and somebody moving into town or people with new ideas could now bring their projects up and say, great, now my turn. So if it's the library, you know it's going to get paid off. And then you go to your rec center, and you know it's going to get paid off. With respect to this bill, to begin to change that characteristic so you're using it for a continuing obligation that never ends, now you've now consumed that opportunity to do specific projects. So your predecessors, or the prior voters, if you will, exhausted all of your tax event for ongoing maintenance, and there will never be an end to that tax because by its characteristic, general operations or even road maintenance in a generic sense, it never ends. So the only way you could get in to build your next rec center is to go and unravel the statute. Going back to, I think it was well said, that the specific purpose statute is a well-designed statute to embody a bunch of controls to always allow you at some given time, usually 5 to 10 years, the opportunity to go do a new project.
These issues were discussed in committee. We took a vote on this amendment. The majority ruled. And as I stated, it's broadened the purpose of that tax. Some people felt like that as long as the people had a chance to vote on it, well, it shouldn't be limited. But at this point, you have a choice to vote on.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I agree with the comments that our chairman just said. just to let you know what the purpose of the amendment was, it is exactly what was said. It opens it just opens it up, and ultimately, if people want to decide they wanted to be taxed for that, they could go ahead and do that. The reason that amendment was brought was the way that the bill is structured right now. You say specific purposes. You add this language in the bill. Specific purposes may include the major maintenance, renovation, or reconstruction of specific sections of public roadways, which seems fine in and of itself until you read the next sentence, which says specific purposes shall not include ordinary operations of local government, except those operations related to the specific project. And that brings out the exact point. If you leave the bill as it is, you're saying, in my mind, you're saying specific purposes include the ordinary operations of government, except they don't include the ordinary operations of government. I don't know what one of the primary functions of local government is to keep your roadways and your streets intact. And so in looking at that, it seemed that what the amendment did was said, fine, if you're going to open it up, open it up. But leaving the bill as it is right now, I think, does that very thing. Ultimately, you're saying, you know, so a specific purpose can include the ordinary operations of local government, because just as the senator from Albany County said, you know, when would major maintenance of a street ever end? When would reconstruction of a street ever end? If you go back to your own communities, are you ever aware of a construction season where that's not happening? Thank you.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I was no vote on this amendment and the bill itself in committee. Mr. Chairman, this point was addressed, that we have a bill that sort of broadens the specific purpose tax, and it's a little bit of a waffle. The language, you have an engrossed copy, and the language was kind of modified down the hall, probably to improvement, but it's talking about, the green bill is talking about using the tax to fund almost anything possible along specific sections of roadway. And I guess you could probably define the roadways that you get the tax for to be all the streets in a town, for example. It's a possibility, I suppose. But it was definitely tied to something specific, and it left in the next language that says this is not about general operations of government. You know, that's the kind of tension we have in a lot of places in our statute, and you kind of work your way through it. The solution to just throw the whole thing out, both restrictions, I don't think is adequate. And I think it raises exactly the specter that's been discussed, that we're taking a specific purpose tax that was designed to protect the taxpayers, designed where people could buy into a tax knowing that, you know, it had an end to it. And that protects small taxpayers and big taxpayers alike. They can buy into a community project, they can do their part, but they know it's going to end. Here, yes, I'm sure it would be time limited, but the truth is the needs would never end, and it goes on and on and on, and you could always roll it over. Well, that's really what the fifth cent is for, Mr. Chairman. We already have that tool. We could expand that, I suppose. But I really feel we've crossed the line on taking a bill that had a specific purpose, literally, and opened it up too far. And so with this amendment on it, I couldn't possibly support this bill. Maybe we could have a decent discussion if we were to strip the amendment off now, and I suggest we vote no.
Ready for the question. All those in favor of Senator Hines' motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 40, please say aye. Those opposed, no. The amendment has failed. We're back on the bill. Are you ready for the question on the bill? One more amendment. House Bill 40, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 to engross copy, page 2, line 8. Mr. Perkins. Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With what we just did to the bill, we don't need this one, so I'll withdraw it.
Has been withdrawn. Are you ready for the question on the bill? Mr. Hines. Senator Hines.
The bill is now back the way it came to us from the House, and we had people speaking in support from it from the local city council and from WHAM. And so that, you know, they're just asking for a little broader
So as I say, that the people get to vote for it depending on whether you vote for it now or not.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, reluctant on the bill and reluctantly against it. I mean, with what we've done, for the very reasons we've talked about, with the bills it is, we basically said that major maintenance, renovation of and reconstruction of specific sections of public roadways, we're basically saying those are no longer those are no longer ordinary operations of government. We're saying those are now specific purposes for which this bill can be, for which you can do these elections and have the special tax. And actually, it's a significantly broad. It's right the way it is now, as it came to us from the House. It's a significant broadening of what the special or the cap facilities tax is, kind of what we refer to it as. And it's a significant broadening of that. And just as the senator from Albany said, ultimately now, if you do that and if you permit this, when would it ever end? Will you ever have a street that's not going to be repaired in your town, for which you will not be, people will not be seeking to have this tax renewed? You know, we have been, and in our 5-cent tax in our neck of the woods, I have voted for that every time. It's a good thing. Our caps and our community supports that, has for 20 years now. But we have yet to pass a capital facilities tax in our community, because the community will not stand behind the projects that have been brought forth. When you do this and broaden it the way that we have, how does anybody stand up and fight against new, better streets? Thanks.
Senator Barnard.
Mr. Chairman, I think we have to look at why this is coming into play here. The cities have reached the point where they don't have money to repair their streets in a normal way. I've sat on the city council the last 6 years, and we've watched our income just go down and down and down and down. We didn't resurface our, we didn't have the money to resurface our streets because for the last 2 years. And we normally put a slurry seal on them, and that's general maintenance. We didn't even have the money to do that. So ask yourselves, why is this coming? It's coming here because the local governments, especially small towns and cities, don't have the money to do these projects, and they need this so that they can make a specific thing for a specific time for a specific area and a one-time deal to repair it. So I ask that you give them that chance to do that.
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, just to enlighten everybody just a little bit on this sixth penny, this isn't something that Cheyenne by itself or Evanston by itself can go out and put in place. The statutes say specifically the resolution that gets created has to be adopted by 2/3 of the municipalities and county, okay, before this can go anywhere. So if you want to do road repairs and street maintenance in Cheyenne, you got to go to Pine Bluffs. They have to sign on. 2/3 of the municipalities and county have to sign on. I'm not sure we need this. We're really opening it up, widening this thing out there, and vote it up or vote it down, but I'm not real excited about this bill.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I don't believe the deficiency actually exists in the language that's added to opening it up, because I can recall in Goshen County that we had $100,000 worth of gravel on a specific purpose tax one time. But so I'm not sure whether we have to actually use the language there, but the deficiency is in the original language, lines 7 and 8, where the exception is those operations related to a specific project. First part of that says specific purposes shall not include ordinary operations of local government. Goes on, except those operations related to a specific project. So that's the loophole in the original language that we have. So I think if you're trying to close a loophole, the thing to do is probably keep it alive till second reading, figure out some language that would close the loophole that already exists in the current law.
Senator Scott.
And maybe I'm wrong about how these things can work, but I'm starting to see some virtue in this bill. That... once we keep it from being broadened out, the way it comes to us in the engrossed version is for construction of specific sections of public roadways. Now, if you have a proposition where, say, your large city in the county wants to build potentially a specific facility that will be useful to them, and they need to get the approval of a number of the small towns, the small towns may have some very specific sections of street that they need to reconstruct. They can't otherwise afford to do because their revenues are simply not enhanced. And you may be able to strike a deal where the specific facilities tax is for the large item plus some of these things that the smaller towns want, and structure something that can pass. And where it says specific sections of public roadways, I think the engrossed version gives us a protection that potentially can be used. So I think we need to look at this. I don't think the existing language, specific purposes shall not include ordinary operation of government except operations related to a specific project. What that allows you is to put in an operation and maintenance fund for your specific project, and that is a very good thing. You don't want to mess with that ability because it allows you to collect a fund so that whatever facility you build isn't a drag on your future operations. So you don't want to mess with that. But I think the bill, as in its current form, Mr. Chairman, does have some virtue.
Ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Hines' motion, when the Committee of the Whole rise to report that do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 40, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Division being called for. All in favor, please stand. Those opposed, please rise. House Bill 40 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 50.
House Bill number 50, sponsored by Representative Brown, Insurance Fraud Prevention, an act relating to insurance. It was referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee whole rise to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 50, that it do pass. And for an explanation of this House bill on insurance fraud prevention, I would give you the number one anti-insurance fraud person in the Senate, the good senator from Sweetwater County and Uinta County. Lincoln. No, he's not. No, Senator Cooper, wherever he is from.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to bring you House Bill 50, as was mentioned, insurance fraud prevention. Mr. Chairman, the law as it is under 26.2.139 currently provides immunity from liability for a person cooperating with furnishing information regarding suspected insurance code violations. When this information is delivered to the insurance commissioner, the commissioner's authorized representative or an examiner, and it provides that it was done all in good faith and with no fraudulent intent. What this amendment to 26.2.131B under B does is what we call the insurance code. It does two things. First of all, on page 2, lines 3 and 4, it adds law enforcement agencies, or any other governmental agency established to detect and prevent insurance fraud. Also, this means that a person now can cooperate with and provide information to these agencies with the same immunity as if it was done, as long as it was done in good faith. Also, in Section B on lines 5 and 6 of the bill, it adds, or any other investigation, which means it could be if there was a federal investigation going on, or a local investigation, or investigation by the DCI or someone else. Also, in Section C, then, again, on page 2, on line 1, it adds the letter or the Section B to be included so that any person under that section can be the above section can be also included in those remedies. Section C addresses entitlement of awards of attorney's fees and costs for any person identified in Section A and or B in a civil cause of action for libel, slander, etc. If the action was not substantially justified, in other words, they'll be able to, if somebody tries to sue the person providing the information to these agencies and these organizations, and they prevail, they will be awarded their attorney's fees and costs in those cases. Mr. Chairman, that pretty much sums up the bill, except for one more thing I probably need to say, and that is the intent of the bill is to allow law enforcement to investigate insurance fraud under criminal code without the language in the bill. It would only refer to Title 26 in the insurance commissioner's jurisdiction. It is important that insurance companies are able to talk with law enforcement outside of Title 26 so they can proceed with their own investigation, especially since we do not have a fraud bureau here in Wyoming like many of the states have. And, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'll stand for questions, but actually the good chairman of the Judiciary Committee, I think, will handle the questions. Thank you.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, okay, I'll look at him. Maybe I don't understand this, probably not, but what it sounds to me like is you have an insurance company, private company, for-profit outfit out here, and they think there's some kind of a fraud, so they go to law enforcement or any state agency whose job is to investigate crime and whatnot, and without a subpoena, a discovery, or any of those other fancy words that the lawyers use to get information, we're saying that this private company now can go directly to our law enforcement without any of those protections to the citizens and get that information because they need to investigate it and they don't need a subpoena or discovery or anything like that. Is that right?
Senator Perkins.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it is right. What you have is, it's not, certainly insurance companies are included in this statute, as is any person. What it does is this: let's look where you are right now. Where you are right now is no cause of action shall arise, nor shall any liability be imposed against any person. That person, as you know, persons includes for-profit corporations, non-profit corporations, individuals. So any individual coming forward and reporting to the insurance commissioner that information or data under this chapter, so if you contribute to an identification, it provides that immunity. Insurance companies are definitely included in that. What you have right now is the commissioner. And I don't know that anybody has to have a search warrant, subpoena, or issue discovery or anything to do that in any event. What you have is what you're really talking about is: are you going to allow these individuals to come forward and and talk to law enforcement agencies about fraud, about suspected fraud, and see if they want, see if they refer that to the appropriate law enforcement agency, who would then investigate presumably to the fraud. Does that provide immunity to insurance companies? Absolutely. That's exactly what the bill does. Those same insurance companies have immunity now to tell the commissioner, but they can't tell law enforcement. Quite frankly, I don't know why insurance companies need to have immunity to do the right thing if they feel if they have the strength of their own convictions. Nevertheless, it seems to get in their way to some degree. The one benefit and the only counterproductive thing, and the only reason I'm a yes on this bill, is in paragraph C or subsection C, which is on page 2, and that provides that if somebody comes up and does this with fraudulent intent, or you have an insurance company who would do it as a dilatory tactic to avoid or delay paying a claim, if they do that, then that gives you or me, the person who may be accused or information turned over to be investigated for fraud, it gives you the right to go back. And if you prevail in a civil or a libel or slander lawsuit, you can recover your attorney's fees against the insurance company. As is right now, you couldn't do that. And so that provides the one counterbalancing, I think, and redeeming quality of this bill. You're kind of a tough spot. I would ask for a show of hands of how many people enjoy working with their insurance company, but I'm afraid that that would be not a very much of an endorsement of what we feel about insurance companies. But the other side of that thing is fraud is a nationwide and very consistent and very real problem. Insurance fraud affects each of us as consumers because the claims insurance, it's wide-reaching and far-reaching. There are individuals who set up, as the testimony came to the committee, there are individuals who set up and groups who actually do this on a consistent basis, making fraudulent claims. And ultimately that affects all of our insurance rates. And so it's really a tough spot. Do you grant insurance companies immunity or and try to fight insurance fraud a little bit better, or do you say no and just allow the insurance companies to remain quiet and to not report that fraud and fight it? It's one of those that you may have to hold your nose and vote yes, or you may just vote no. But that's the bill that we bring to you.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I've got some questions about this, and I'm always hesitant any time we start giving immunity to anybody. But we've seen a trend over the most recent years of expanding immunity, which means they're not liable, period. You don't have a case, even because they are immune. I'm a little bit even more hesitant of giving insurance companies immunity. But as I understand this bill, it's better than it was in the House, as the good chairman of judiciary said, because of paragraph C. But I still think it's awfully, awfully broad. The examples that are used in support of this bill is allowing insurance company to go and talk directly with law enforcement. But this is way bigger than just law enforcement. It is any governmental agency. What agencies are those? Or any other investigation. What the heck is that? I don't know. What if Joe Senator, want to conduct an investigation? Is it within my purview? I don't know. But I think this bill takes an awfully broad brush, and I'm going to need some help to answer these questions, to even give me some sort of comfort level.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, a few years ago, this was a Joint Corporations Committee bill. And the testimony that we had in that interim that produced the bill was that what was going on was that when an insurance company tried to report and insured for some fraudulent act, that the key thing was the ability to report it to law enforcement. And when they tried to do that, that absent the immunity, they were at risk of being, they were threatened and were at risk of getting a lawsuit from the insured that was perpetrating the fraud, a civil lawsuit essentially designed to prevent the report. And the effect of that was that the risk managers in the insurance company were taking the point of view that we can't afford the legal risk. Again, Mr. Chairman, in some way a testimony to the difficulties in our legal system. But they couldn't afford the legal risk of having to defend such a suit because it would be very expensive. So they were taking the cheap way out and saying, okay, we just aren't going to report them. We'll just jack everybody's price up. It's just like a grocery store with shoplifters. You don't do anything about it, you get a certain percentage of loss, and you just raise all your prices. And that's the way that works. Same principle, except I think the numbers can be quite a good deal larger in some of the cases. And the result costs all of us quite a bit. I thought it would be wise to broaden the thing so that people who reported an insurance company for problems, we didn't have to face that kind of treatment by the insurance company on a fair as fair basis. But that particular provision wasn't liked, and I think may have been the reason the bill didn't pass. But there's a real problem out there, and frankly, Mr. Chairman, it is one more of the many ways in which our legal system is being abused. And this is one of the difficulties. You don't pass exemptions like this. You are encouraging the fraud because people are scared to report it because they don't want to get sued. And in this case, this particular protection is just for insurance companies, and I wonder about that. But and it may well be too broad, and we ought to rein it in on second reading. But there's a real purpose here, and defeating this bill will cause, going forward, higher insurance rates that will be higher than they otherwise would be.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, on and for the bill. In our committee hearing, we had testimony from a police officer from that quaint little town on the western side of the state that lies underneath those grand mountains with the French name. And he described the example of an insurance agent coming to him and say, would you get a subpoena? And he said, what do I need a subpoena for? Well, I can't tell you. You need to get a subpoena. And that circular action of, I can't get a subpoena without the evidence. And going back and forth. And he was very specific and feeling very frustrated about this. It may be a little broader at the moment, but by moving this forward, we have that opportunity to tighten it up. Remember, the insurance companies aren't the ones that are losing the money. All they're doing is balancing the books and passing it on to the people who aren't involved in the fraud.
Just majority floor leader.
Just one question. So I think perhaps the good senator from Teton County answered my initial question, was what happens now? I'm guessing that they go to the insurance commissioner, and apparently the insurance commissioner can't say, then maybe we ought to give the insurance commissioner the immunity to go to law enforcement and ask, rather than the other way around, and perhaps you balance the plate a little bit with regards to consumers that maybe feel that there's some sort of fraud or whatever going on. I don't really have a real problem with talking to law enforcement, but you know, it's so broad with any other governmental agency or any other investigation. I'm wondering if we, you know, you've opened the door too big.
You ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises a report, that to do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 50, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is passed. Clerk will read the next bill, House Bill 55.
House Bill number 55, sponsored by Representative Berger, Perfection of Security Interest Titled Personal Property, and Act Relating to Secured Transactions. It was referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I rise once again and move that when the committee of the whole rise to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of due pass to House Bill 55, Perfection of Security Interests Entitled Personal Property, and for a... An explanation of the bill, I request that you call upon the good senator from KC.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 55, Perfection of Security Interest, Title Personal Property, came about in 2000. We redid the UCC filing statutes, and we worked our way through that. It was rather a thick bill, of which almost every senator read parts of. When we were working through it, in terms of the filing a security interest on automobiles, specifically automobiles that are on a lot, a sales lot, what we did, we were required we left out, and it's on page 2 of the bill, on line 5, we said there are no statutes that apply. And, in fact, there are statutes that apply. It's the statutes that you see there, 31-2-101 through 105. These are the statutes that deal with the vehicle certificates of title. And what it amounts to, if you're a dealer, you're going to get the vehicles on your lot financed, you do have to file with the under the UCC. If this goes through, you do have to file with the Secretary of State for all the automobiles on your lot. The automobiles can come and go, the individual ones, but for the automobiles that are there, it's a filing on all of them. It's a financing thing. But it also has implications that it means the titles will be correct on all those automobiles that are sold. Right now it's kind of gray, kind of a dark gray actually, and this clarifies that. This is how you do it. It's mechanical, but it needs to be done, particularly for people buying cars off a lot and the people that are financing those cars. I would stand for any questions.
Ready for the question. All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises a report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 55, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. House Bill 55 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 66. Would the reader please read the bill?
House Bill number 66, sponsored by Representative Stubson, Industrial Siding Financial Resources, and Act Relating to Industrial Siding. It was referred to Committee number 9, Mineral Business and Economic Development, which reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cole, Cooper, Jennings, and Rothfuss. Senator Bebout, Chairman.
Senator Bebout. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move when the committee of the whole rise and report it do so with the recommendation House Bill 66 do pass, Industrial Siding Financial Resources, and I'll yield to Senator Perkins for discussion on the bill. Senator Perkins. There are no standing committee amendments.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, what we've got in House Bill 66 is bringing back to you a bill that was almost a similar bill that was here a year ago. What this is we went back and going back a couple years more, I and the primary sponsor brought a bill in here, and we instituted and expanded significantly the authority of the Industrial Siting Council. And included in that was a number of permits, and it was aimed at grappling and grasping for a regulation over the wind energy industry. And ultimately, those laws passed, and they went in. And so we have a significant expansion and the review of the Industrial Siting Council over the permitting process for both wind and other entities. One of the things that happened in that and that came up is one of the requirements is that if you go to page 2 in lines 5 through 6, you see one of the things that the information that's in the existing law is that information demonstrating the applicant's financial capability to decommission and reclaim the facility, and also, but what's the issues that you have is for facilities meeting the definition of Wyoming Statute 3512.102A, you see the reference there, the information should also demonstrate the applicant's financial capability to construct, maintain, and operate the facility. And that's what this gets down to, is one of the requirements that happens for any applicant who currently comes before the Industrial Siting Commission is that they have to demonstrate the applicant's financial capability not only to construct and maintain, but also to operate the facility. When we brought this in doing that, what you now have is the Industrial Siting Commission, who is very good at overseeing and looking at the permitting process for the effects on the environment, the effects on and reconciling the community interests, the parties that are affected, providing that notice, holding the hearing, and finding out a long list of everybody who provides notice, everybody from local governments to the archaeology group to SHPO on historical features to a long laundry list, about 17 to 20 some individuals who are notified of these permits, and they all have the ability to come forward and talk about how they may be affected. But one of the things that is a concern of this, and if you're before the Industrial Siting Commission, you've got a project that's worth about, I think you've got to have about $170 odd million facility that's under construction. And so now you've got the Industrial Siting not only looking at all these other things, but now in particular deciding whether or not this entity has the financial capability not only to construct but to maintain and operate the facility. And so the question that we bring to you is that really what you want? Do you want the Industrial Siting Commission to be an overall to look at the financial capability of individuals who bring major projects to the state of Wyoming and determine whether or not in the Industrial Siting Commission's opinion they have the financial wherewithal and the ability and the cash flows to not only construct, but to maintain and operate the facilities. You know, generally, I would think that construction is not a big problem, Mr. Chairman, because you've got bonds and other things. But when you look at maintaining and operating the facility, I don't know what expertise and the ability that the Industrial Siting Commission has to look at that and to make that decision as we go, which is, I believe, well monitored by the bondholders and the lenders and all the other people that are involved in projects of this size to determine the financial feasibility of these structures. But nevertheless, when we brought this a couple years ago, we were taking this all the way out. What this bill does is it takes it out except for wind. It leaves with the Industrial Siting Commission the ability to oversee those issues with respect to the construction and the maintenance and the operation of the facility, but would remove it for the other entities, leaves wind so they're still bound by that, but removes that consideration from the Industrial Siting the Industrial Siting Commission for those other facilities. And we know about some of those, what those might be. We have gas to liquids plants. We have, it could be transmission lines. It could be anything, almost any major industrial project that would be $170 million or more. So that's what we bring to you. The opposition in particular, when we brought this to you last year, were wind companies, and with the new ability of wind companies and the uncertainty with respect to tax credits and others, there was concern whether or not they would be commercially viable into the future, Mr. Chairman. So what we've done is we've left those still burdened and still having to meet that qualification, but for other non-wind energy related projects, we've removed that ability and believe that the market will justify and regulate and monitor that sufficiently, especially with respect to the ability to maintain and operate those facilities. With that explanation, Mr. Chairman, I would stand for questions.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would have two questions on this bill. One would be, can you give us the evolution of the changes from 2 years ago with last year's bill to this year? By this, are we actually lowering standards on other industries from 2 years ago? And I just don't know the answer. The second question, Mr. Chairman, is not being that schooled in the legal profession, is there an equal protection kind of argument that someone could bring down the road and actually have the requirements on the wind industry thrown out of this? And so that's my questions, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Try to answer those questions. The Industrial Siding Act became law in 1975. And in 1975, the financial capability to construct, maintain, and operate were not part of it. And since that time, and I may be a little off on my numbers, but I believe 45 plants have been under the Industrial Siding Act that have gone through that process, have been approved, and have been built. And back in 75, I think the threshold was around $85 million. We put an inflation factor into that, and now it's up to like $186 million. So all these years, this has not been imposed upon them. The way that got into this situation, and my colleague from Neutronic can correct me, but when we did the wind and we had the task force, we went in the Industrial Siding Act statutes and changed it because wind is treated differently. The threshold is not $186 million for projects there under wind. I believe it's for 50 wind turbines. I may be wrong on that number, but there's a different threshold there. And so we had a different situation relative to what would be under the Industrial Siding Act for many of the concerns we all have about the capability of people to really be able to get the wind production up and going. And a lot of us remember what happened at Medicine Bow where they built two or three of those windmills and we had to come back in and clean them up. So that was, and then we fast forward to where we are now. And the feeling is that we should go back to where we treated those Industrial Siding Act people that came through that process, those companies, and treat them the same the way they've always been treated. We have the decommission and reclaim is still in there. So under the Industrial Siding Act, they can do an assurity, have a bond, and do all those kind of things to be sure that these larger plants can decommission and reclaim. There again, for wind, it's a little different situation, and all those are included for wind. As far as the Equal Protection Clause, I think that probably is answered because the wind has a different threshold than the Industrial Siding Act relative to the other plants was strictly a financial, the cost of them, how much they cost to build.
Senator Von Platter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. Isn't the Industrial Siding Act what brings us up to the impact funding? Don't they go through that first in the hearings? Then the impact funding comes from that point somewhere, and then the distribution amongst the towns impacted. Doesn't that all come through that Industrial Siding Act and the council in there? Because we have at least one power station that was never financed. We still don't think after 13 years is still going to be financially viable. So, but impact money was given out. So by removing this, did they already miss it once and allowed a project to go forward? And then this would remove that filter again, even though they probably blew it once.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back, just one correction, the threshold for wind is 30 towers and not 50 towers. So, and going back and talking about the evolution of that was that these provisions were not in the statute until the co-sponsor and I, who had served for probably 3 years on the Wind Energy Task Force, and the Wind Energy Task Force, not an entity created by the legislature, was able to produce legislation. So we embarked as a result of our efforts on that, and we actually brought the legislation that imposed these obligations. The senator from Campbell County is exactly right. It's through the Industrial Siting Commission is where the impact monies for sales taxes and the other taxes that are done. This won't affect that. It doesn't mean that something doesn't come under the Industrial Siting Act, or it does. It simply removes, and what it does is removes from consideration one of the issues of issuing the permit from the Industrial Siting Council of whether or not the applicant is going to have to come in and demonstrate financial capability not only to construct but to maintain and operate the facility. Again, I don't think you necessarily have to worry about the financial capability to construct because typically you've got revenue bonds and you've got other individuals who, not revenue bonds, you've got construction bonds, completion bonds, and other things like that that are generally done to do that. The financing, when you get back to these things and how these large projects are financed, typically you've got lenders and others who are actively looking at these things, and particularly in light of recent events, those lending opportunities, people are being more selective, trying to reduce their risk on loans. But ultimately, I think that the market does an excellent job of constructing and maintaining, of deciding whether a company is going to be financially feasible before it's even financed. I think the one exception, and one of the reasons why wind is an exception to that, is one, this body has not been willing to look at that and remove that examination for wind. And so that's why that's one of the reasons wind is exempted out. The other one, too, is that, you know, a lot of these other entities don't necessarily have the subsidies that we find in the wind energy market. And so it is a differentiation. As far as going to the equal protection argument, I think that when you look at that, I think if you were singling out particular wind energy projects from other wind energy projects, I think that that creates the potential for an equal protection entity. But to sit there and to have not to, or to say that there's equal protection of a power plant compared to a wind energy compared to a coal to liquids facility, I don't think there's equal protection arises in that instance. You're looking for similarly situated people in the same way, and also for the reasons that my good friend from Fremont County pointed out, is that the threshold is also different. It's 30 wind towers as opposed to $170 million worth of construction costs. I've tried to answer your questions. If I haven't, let me know.
You ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Bebout's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that to do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 66, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 66 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 72. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Oh,
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Senate stand at ease for purposes of a five-minute break.
Well, how about that?
Does that make you feel good? You bet.
Thank you.
Get everything lined out, then I break my rhythm. We're working on a quorum. Go. Senator Burns, please go get a quorum.
That's what he gets for whining.
What? We get everybody to come in for quorum, please. What? Pretty please. What? Okay. Okay, we have a quorum. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 72. Clerk, please read.
House Bill number 72, sponsored by Representative McComey, Juvenile Detention Facility Placements, and Act Relating to School Districts. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Barnard, Cole, Jennings, Landon, Ruffa, Senator Co-Chairman.
Senator Jennings.
Seeing I can't find my chairman. Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rises, I hope it does so with a favorable consideration of House Bill 72. I guess I get this. Hope I can remember this. Basically, all this does is that when you have kids in juvenile detention in a school district, the school district where they're detained gets the ADM. So if you have you have them coming in, is this your? Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to defer to the guy that was supposed to do this bill, the senator from Edmonton, Senator Barnard.
Mr. Chairman, the good senator from Natrona County was right. I'll try to just elaborate really quickly on what he said. This bill comes to us. It's a really simple bill, and it's an equity bill, and it's meant to correct an inequity of payments. When a person, a young person under the age of 18, is incarcerated, they can't go to a regular county jail. They have to go to a special thing called the detention center. There are five of these in Rock Springs, Jackson, Lander, Casper, and Cheyenne. When a student checks into one of these detention centers, he is coming from the resident center. That's where resident school district. That's where he was. To a non-resident school district. This bill would make it possible for a tuition agreement to be made between the non-resident or the detention center education facility to get money from the resident detention center. And not all of these kids who go there are equally, equally endowed with their faculties, so some of them have greater educational needs than others, and so that's why it's a tuition agreement, okay, because some kids are going to cost more than others. And so this will enable them to have a tuition agreement and a tuition payment. The school that gets the money, if they have to claim this ADM, then their money will go up, and then the next time when they're evaluated, they won't get as much money, so that works to their disfavor. And so what this will do, will make sure that these detention facility schools get their fair share of the money. They won't get charged for it, and the other residential school district will pay for that. So we're going to solve two problems here. It's a really simple bill. I ask your consideration on it.
Question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Jennings' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report that to do so with a favorable recommendation, House Bill 72, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 72 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 88. Reader will read.
Prone, DUI penalties, an act relating to motor vehicles. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation. I, Burns, and Escobelks, and Perkins, Chairman.
Senator Burns. Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Chairman, I move that when the committee of whole rise to report that it do so with a favorable do-pass recommendation on House Bill 88, DUI penalties, for an explanation of there are no standing committee amendments, for an explanation of the bill, I ask that you call upon the good senator from Park County.
Senator Cole.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this bill just changes the penalty provisions, and if you go actually to page 4, that's where it all happens. Starting on line 9, it said, on a fourth offense resulting in a conviction of subsequent conviction within 10 years for a violation of this section, which is DUI, or other law prohibiting driving while under the influence, he shall be guilty of a felony and fined not more than $10,000, punished by imprisonment for not more than changes to 2 sentences of somebody that has had 4 within a 10-year period. That's all the bill does. Try to answer questions.
Question have been called for. All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report that it do so with favorable recommendation of House Bill 72, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. All those. Okay, I'll start over. Thank you. All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion when the Committee of the Whole rise to report that do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 88, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 88 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Joint Resolution Number 6. Will the reader please read the bill?
House Joint Resolution Number 6, Post Office Closure, sponsored by Representative Stewart. A joint resolution requesting Congress to issue a moratorium on the closing of United States Postal Service offices in Wyoming. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Election and Political Subdivisions, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, and Johnson. No, Senators Martin and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the committee to report it to the past recommendation on House Joint Resolution 6, Post Office Closures. For next bill, I yield to the Senator from Bergen County.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate, I would ask for your favorable consideration on House Joint Resolution 6. Let me explain the resolution. As we know, the problem is because of inefficient and inadequate management. But one of their cost savings criteria that they're now implementing across the nation is closing 3,000 postal offices. Unfortunately, the post office will close almost every one of those very rural areas in the state of Wyoming. I'm going to read a list, just as you all know that the bulk majority of you are going to have post office closed in your district. I'll start out with Alva, Arvada, Arbon, Bear Oil, Capital Station, Cora, Crowheart, Deaver, Devil's Tower, Dixon, Edgerton, Emblem, Fairview, Frontier, F.E. Warren Air Force Base, Granger, Grover, Hawk Springs, Horse Creek, Huntley, Hyattville, Lance Creek, Leiter, Lynch, Little America, Opal, Otto, Parkman, Powder River, Recluse, Robertson, Smoot, Savory, Tie Siding, Van Tassel, Veteran, Wyarno, Frontier, and Meridian. The ones that are slated for first closure are in Byron, Freedom, Hartville, JM, Lost Springs, and Manville. Basically, with this resolution, you know how the resolutions, you can go to the last page 3, with the resolution, they put a moratorium on closing time, second on a study to calculate real costs are on the mechanism they can convene for services in the local and other countries.
I'll just answer Casey for the rule recommendation of House Joint Resolution Number 6.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The resolution has failed. Pursuant to Senate 11-5, all of you, please stand. All those opposed, please rise. The bill is pursuant to S-5, having the Senate division, a roll call vote is required. The chief clerk of the...
Hicks, Hines, Jennings, Johnson, Landon, Martin, Meyer, Nicholas, Perkins, Peterson, Ross, Buffus, Schiffer, Scott, Leiter, President Anderson. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 5 ayes.
House Joint Resolution 6, having failed a roll call vote pursuant to Senate Rule 11-5A, is deemed indefinitely postponed. Majority floor leader.
I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
Your motion, all in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed?
Mr. President, bills on general file begs leave to report as follows. House Bill 4, do pass. House Bill 5, do pass. House Bill 15, do pass. House Bill 16, do pass. House Bill 38, do pass, amended. House Bill 40, do pass, amended. House Bill 50, do pass. House Bill 55, do pass. House Bill 66, do pass. House Bill 72, do pass. House Bill 88, do pass. House Joint Resolution 6, failed to pass Committee of the Whole and was indefinitely postponed. Senator Driscoll, Chairman.
Good, Senator Driscoll.
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
Heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Respectfully request that House Bill 93, that's currently in Committee Number 4, be re-referred to Committee Number 10, Labor.
Thank you. The request is that House Bill 93 be re-referred from Committee 4 to Committee 10. Are there any objections? Hearing none, that is so ordered. Thank you, Co-Senator Scott.
Mr. President, I've been asked to announce in relation to House Bill 25, the private transfer fee bill, there's been an announcement, a document circulated with Senator Hicks's thing, and he commends it to your attention. Don't pay attention to the first part of the top part of the first page because it relates to a different issue. The material relevant to the bill starts at the bottom of the page.
Thank you, Mr. President. Appropriations Committee Number 2 will meet this evening upon adjournment. First, to consider House Bill 26, Contractor Residency Provisions. House Bill 27, Engrossed Extension of Energy Producing States Coalition. Tomorrow morning at 8, we'll be considering, you know, I just think the bills I just read to you, Mr. President, those are tomorrow at 8. Upon adjournment, the following three bills, House Bill 78, Mixed Martial Arts, House Bill 99, Baseline Scientific Assessments, and we'll be talking about House Bill 1, the General Government Appropriations, to learn about the differences between the House and the Senate. And tomorrow, upon adjournment, we'll consider House Bill 116, Engrossed Impact Assistance to Local Governments, and if there are anything else referred to us, tonight, tomorrow, or we'll consider it tomorrow evening as well.
Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, and Water Resources, will meet Thursday night upon adjournment. We'll take up House Bill 18, Engrossed notification of public land tentative water right changes, House Bill 7, engrossed voluntary livestock identification program, H.J.R. 10, engrossed rural long-distance phone services, H.J.R. 8, National Day of the Cowboy.
Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, is going back to work. We're going to meet Friday morning at 8 o'clock, room S11, to take up House Bill 77, Charter Schools, Average Daily Membership, House Bill 95, Student-to-Teacher Ratio Waiver, and House Bill 108, Engrossed Professional Teaching Standards Board Teacher Certification.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet Friday, March the 2nd, at 8A Room in S1 for our last day to consider House bills. Those House bills that we will be considering will be House Joint Resolution 3, Resolution Parents' Rights, House Bill 62, Engrossed Investigative Subpoenas, House Bill 112, Engrossed Battery Against a Family Member.
Mr. President, your committee number 6, Tribal Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, will meet at 8 a.m. up in S14 tomorrow morning to discuss House Bill 76, engrossed resort liquor licenses, House Joint Resolution 13, engrossed resolution in support of Central Park Wilderness. We will also discuss, for anybody interested, interim topics. And, Mr. President, if I could ask the members of TRW to meet here at my desk upon adjournment for about a minute and a half, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, will meet at 4:30 up in S14 to take up House Bill 21, Exceeding Speed Limit While Passing, and House Bill 22, Gold Star License Plates, Expanded Eligibility. Gold Star. Gold Star.
Tomorrow, we could very well continue to discuss.
Is that Robert O'Mendez? Actually, there is a bill out there. Love you, I've been raising this bill. Yeah, Love Now's got one. I was raising it today. It's economic development.
Thank you, Mr. President. Members of the Senate, in particular the majority party, we will caucus once we gavel in tomorrow to consider the governor's appointments to the various boards and commissions and directorships. And with that, so go ahead and make sure you've reviewed that tonight. With that, I'd move that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. Thursday, March 1st.
What does Bill Austin open it up the exception so much as follows the